Hello, and welcome to the Healthy Balanced Birth and Beyond podcast. I'm Olivia, your host, and on this podcast, we will talk about everything related to the journey to conceive, pregnancy, labor, birth, postpartum, parenthood, and beyond. This is a safe space where birth professionals, birthing people, expectant parents, and partners can come on and share their knowledge or personal experiences with our listeners. The goal of this podcast is to create connections, share stories, information, and resources to educate and empower people in their own personal journey. Hello, listeners. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Healthy Balanced Birth and Beyond podcast. Today, I have my friend Julie Brill with us. Julie and I connected last year, I think via Facebook, because we were in a couple different groups together. And she was hosting a breastfeeding workshop. And while I was pregnant with Lula, I still wanted to learn more about breastfeeding and kind of just educate myself a little bit more, because that was something that I still felt like I needed a little more knowledge surrounding before I had my own. So I reached out to her via email, went to her breastfeeding workshop, which was absolutely amazing. And I learned so many things. So Julie is on the podcast with us today. She is a certified lactation consultant. She is a childbirth educator. So Julie, would you like to introduce yourself to everybody?
Sure. Hi, everybody. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Olivia. I'm Julie Brill, and I'm in Bedford, Massachusetts, although right now I'm mostly working virtually everywhere.
Yep.
And I'm an international board certified lactation consultant and a certified childbirth educator. I've been working with parents for 28 years since 1992.
Awesome.
So a long time. We're like kind of on the second generation of babies now. A lot has changed, and some significant things are really very much the same.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the podcast is because I felt like I learned so much from the breastfeeding workshop myself, and things that I didn't know even when I went to look things up online or look in books, about latches and about like the tongue ties, just so many different things that I just hadn't even considered. And that's one thing that I feel like sometimes we just blindly go into having a baby and not knowing certain things about it. And then you're in this situation where you're like, okay, I want to breastfeed my baby, but you don't know anything about it. And so for me, like, I like to know things so I can have a general idea of how things are going to go. And so could you share with us like some of the things that you see most of your clients struggling with, or people come to you with asking questions about?
Sure. I mean, I think probably the most common reasons people reach out is pain, nipple pain or breast pain, or concerns about production. And when I hear from people with either of those concerns, I always feel like it's an emergency, partly because everything in postpartum is so intense. And, you know, if you're feeding a baby, a newborn, 10 or 12 times a day, and it's not going well, that's 10 or 12 frustrating sessions every day.
Mm-hmm.
But also because pain and perceived insufficient milk supply are the two most common reasons that people wean before they've met their breastfeeding goals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's urgent when people are struggling with either of those things. And then also people with overproduction,
mm-hmm.
Which seems like a nice problem if you have underproduction, but isn't.
Yeah.
Plug ducts. Mastitis, sometimes just people who are trying to figure out pumping and bottles and going back to work or school. Weaning is another common one.
Yeah. Because I've heard from a couple different people who, like, for example, like you said, things about thinking that they don't have a big enough supply. So people who are like, oh, well, I'm not leaking, or my breasts feel soft, or that sort of thing. Can you like explain how that may be perceived that way, but how to kind of encourage somebody that even if it's not what it seems, they still do have that supply?
Sure. So typically what happens is you have colostrum through the second half of the pregnancy, and then the first few days postpartum, and then the mature milk starts to transition. And when that happens, it's often dramatic in that there's often more milk than the baby needs. Sometimes people feel quite full. Sometimes there's leaking, as you were saying. And so people think, oh, this is what it is to have good milk production. And that's really actually like a little cushion of overproduction that mm-hmm. people often have in the beginning. You know, in case your baby has initial issues transferring, usually the mother's body is a little more generous than it's going to be later on.
Right.
So even though we talk about it being demand and supply all the time, in the beginning with the hormones, there's sort of this little cushion of extra milk for many people. And then over time, your body becomes more efficient, which is good. You don't want to be engorged and leaking all the time. But many people will wonder if that's actually not enough milk as the supply is regulating. So that's one thing that I see a lot. Also, the interesting thing about leaking is some people leak and some people don't, mm-hmm. and it's not necessarily related to production. So you have these sphincter muscles in your nipples that hold the milk in. And if you have tighter muscles, you are going to leak less or not leak at all. But sometimes people with underproduction will leak. People with overproduction might not leak. So they're actually not necessarily related. So, I mean, anybody who's thinking that maybe they don't have enough milk production, I mean, that would definitely be a reason to reach out to an IBCLC. We're mm-hmm. here for you. Things that people often do when they're concerned are pump after a feed. And that really doesn't tell you. We don't expect that the baby is going to take all the milk that's available in the breast. It's typically about 2/3 of what's available that's transferred at a feed. Mm-hmm. So if you have milk afterwards, that doesn't mean the baby didn't get enough. And if you pump and you don't get milk afterwards, that also doesn't mean that you didn't make enough, because the baby's the best pump. Yeah. So you're going to have a different emotional experience with your baby than you are with your plastic pump. And letdown is very much related to oxytocin, which is the hormone of love. So just because you don't respond to your pump the way that you respond to your baby doesn't mean that there's a problem either.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you say that, because for me, like, our daughter just, she just wasn't a fan of bottles. We tried in the beginning when she was, I think, like 2 months old. And she just wasn't a fan of them. And I had the flexibility where I could breastfeed her, luckily. Like, I'm thankful for that. And so I remember, like, days where she wasn't eating a lot and I was engorged on one side and I was trying so hard to pump. But it's not the same thing. It's just not. So it's funny, not funny, but, like, interesting that you say that, because it's so true. It's completely different if your baby is breastfeeding versus if you're pumping yourself. One thing I did want to ask for you to explain, just in case people aren't familiar with it, is if you could explain what colostrum is. Sure. Because a lot of people, I feel like, once, if they're not familiar with anything in the birth space or breastfeeding, they may not know what that is.
Yeah, that's a great point. We just, like, kind of throw around these terms as if everybody speaks yeah. the same language. So colostrum is the first milk that you make, and it's very thick. It's yellow, golden color, and it kind of has a consistency like maple syrup, and it's very high in antibodies. So babies aren't sterile. We used to think they were sterile when they were born, but they haven't met all of the bacteria that we meet every day. Mm-hmm. So they come through usually vaginally. They pick up bacteria. In the birth process, they pick up bacteria from being skin to skin with the parent. And then colostrum is the third way that they start to form their microbiome. Mm-hmm. And it's really perfect for babies. If you think about, they're in utero swallowing amniotic fluid, but of course they're not breathing. Mm-hmm. And they come out and they need to coordinate breathing and swallowing, which is pretty sophisticated.
Yeah.
So they have a couple of days of colostrum where the milk is coming at them very slowly, like maple syrup, mm-hmm. and they can figure out how to do that, breathe and swallow. And then typically, if you've had a baby before, day two, if not, sometimes it's more like day three, the mature milk is coming in, and so there's more volume. It comes at the babies faster. It's lighter in color.
Yeah.
And so that's what we talk about.
Yeah, I remember learning all about colostrum, and I was just fascinated by it. I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. And then, obviously, like, I just had my daughter last year, and when I saw it coming out of me, I was like, oh my God, it's so, like, bright yellow. It's crazy, but it's cool. And, like, I feel like that was something that I never learned until I got into the doula space. Like, I didn't know you had this yellow stuff coming out of your nipples. I just thought it was really cool. I mean, some people may be a little freaked out by it if they don't know what it is. So I'm glad that you touched on that and shared that with all of us.
Yeah, colostrum is amazing. I feel like we could sit here for an hour and just talk about colostrum.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. A lot of times people at the end of pregnancy, if they're curious, they'll do a little bit of hand expression.
I was going
to
ask.
Just to see what's there.
Yeah. During my pregnancy, towards the end, my nipples were, like, very, very sensitive. But I wanted to kind of see, I didn't really fully dive into it, but I felt like I had, like, extra stuff coming out almost, which was interesting to me. I didn't try and hand express, but I have seen people do that before baby comes, which is also another cool thing. So one of the things that you touched on a few minutes ago, we were talking about the amount of feedings per day and how if it's painful latches, that can be very frustrating and very tiring. But one thing that I thought of while you were mentioning that was the fact that people say you should try and feed them every 2 to 3 hours. And for me, I remember hearing that and I just felt like my daughter was feeding way more than that, especially as a newborn. And even now as she's older, like during the times that she's teething, she definitely does not go 2 to 3 hours. So maybe just kind of sharing a little bit about like the misconception that babies are only going to eat every 2 to 3 hours or that you shouldn't be trying to feed them more often.
Right. I think that's really important. I think a lot of times people figure, oh, every 3 hours, that's like 8 feeds a day in 24 hours. But if we look at how much milk a baby can hold, newborn, what their stomach volume is, and how much milk they need to consume in 24 hours, 8 times in 24 hours is not going to be enough for most babies. Mm-hmm. 10 is usually a minimum. Many newborns, 12 or more feeds a day, that's normal. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times when people see babies feeding that frequently, 10, 12 or more times in 24 hours, they wonder if they have enough milk. But that's really normal for a newborn to feed that often. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, they come out of this warm, dark uterine environment where they've been fed constantly.
Right.
So it's not surprising that they want to reconnect. You know, breastfeeding is more than just milk for them and also to snack.
I love that you said that because that's one thing that I feel like many people just don't think about it in that way. Like your baby comes from being inside of you 24/7. Being warm, being unafraid, being like nourished whenever they need to. And then they're on the outside and you have to figure out when they are hungry, when they want to be fed, when they want to be held, because they're used to that. So I love that you shared that because I feel like that's something to be mindful of when you have a newborn or even a baby for the first however many months of their lives. Like I remember the days where not only myself, but other people were saying like, they just want to be held. They just want to be held. If I put them down, right. They scream. And you're like,
right.
It can be frustrating, but in the moment, and then you're like, oh, well, you know, they're used to being attached to you 24/7 for almost 9 months. So it's something that is new for them too.
Exactly. I mean, thinking about it from the baby's perspective is fascinating. I always think if there were babies who didn't care, if you put them down, you picked them up, you fed them, you didn't. That's not the baby that survived and contributed to the gene pool. We all descended from babies who were come with babies who were not going to get left on a rock while the tribe moved on.
Right.
It's really a matter of survival. And baby wearing can be such a really helpful game changer
for people
who don't know yet, in terms of meeting that baby's needs to be held and also, you know, trying to fold some laundry or go for a walk or whatever it is.
I was going to say baby wearing right in the immediate postpartum and even now is a game changer for me. I don't know. I know that some babies don't like baby wearing, so every baby's different. But when they're tiny and they just want to be held, so you can either get something done, go for a walk, have lunch with a friend, whatever it is. That's all my daughter wanted. She just wanted to be wrapped up just right on my chest. And I feel like I really enjoyed it, even though it was hard sometimes to still get things done or feel like if I wanted to work out or something like that.
Right.
But it can like creates that emotional connection. It's like another way of connecting with your baby. And I thought it was really sweet.
Yeah. I do think it's a game changer. So many people like who are struggling don't realize there's a way to make it a little bit easier.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So one thing that I wanted to touch on that I have experienced myself, but then also have had friends and or clients talk to me about is feeling like they were not supported in their breastfeeding journey. There are some people that I know who they really, really wanted to breastfeed, but they felt like the people around them weren't very supportive of it. Like they were just quick to say, okay, well, if it's not working, then just give up, you know, just throw your hands up. But it really, really meant a lot to them. So sometimes they did continue and they did keep pushing for it. And then some people felt like they just couldn't because they didn't feel supported in doing so. So would you mind chatting with us for a few minutes about that?
Yeah, I think that's such an important topic. There are all sorts of studies that show that when the partner is on board for breastfeeding, breastfeeding is more likely to be successful, meaning that the mother is more likely to meet her goals and not wean before she wants to. And I feel sometimes for the partners because a lot of us didn't grow up in a world where everybody was breastfeeding.
Right.
And it's such a logical jump if breastfeeding's not going well. And you don't have to do it, right? We have other ways to feed babies. There's bottles, there's donor milk, there's formula, there's other options.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's move to an option that, you know, is the solution to this problem that is breastfeeding, which isn't going well. But for the mom who wants to be able to breastfeed, that's often not the solution. And I think sometimes in a couple, people wind up not feeling heard.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think there's a lot of focus prenatally on childbirth education, which is vital. And not so much on breastfeeding, which is the part that comes next, of course, and that people often think is just going to be natural and easy. And sometimes it is. But if you haven't grown up around breastfeeding babies, if you don't know what to expect, it's not necessarily going to be easy and natural in the beginning. There's often a few week period where people are really on a steep learning curve. So if people are able to educate both parents, educate prenatally about breastfeeding, to have those conversations, why it matters prenatally, I think it makes it easier on the other side.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was going to say too, and I'm glad that you brought that up. I feel like in some families, breastfeeding was just something that no one ever saw growing up. And then in other families, everybody did it.
Right.
So then when your partner is either coming from the side where no one did it, they don't really know about it. They don't really know how to react to it, how to respond to it, how to provide support for it. And then the families that do, that it's completely different. So yeah, and one thing that I was even thinking about while we were chatting wasn't something that you and I planned on talking about before, was like the fact that sometimes people are very uncomfortable seeing other people breastfeeding. And I
Right.
feel like that ties into people feeling like supported in their breastfeeding journey, or even like, I feel like empowered almost. If people aren't, or they're like shying away or won't look at you or ask you to go in another room, it's just another way to kind of feel like you're not supported in what you're doing for your baby.
Yeah.
And I've experienced that myself. So I was just wondering if you had any ideas about like normalizing breastfeeding itself.
I mean, another huge topic, right? But so important. I think that part of it is just one early example of all that parental negotiation, right? Like, I grew up in one home and my life was like this as a kid, and you grew up someplace else and you have ideas about how it's going to be for our kid, and so do I, and we have to kind of negotiate that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes breastfeeding is an early adventure into co-parenting.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of breastfeeding comfortably or breastfeeding discreetly, that's going to be different for different people. One of the old Leche League tricks that works well for a lot of people is you go to a family gathering or, you know, to an event, and you kind of stake out a corner where you're going to be and you're going to breastfeed. So you're not sitting down in the middle of everything. You're setting yourself apart. And then anybody who comes over, it's like they've invited themselves into the space where you are breastfeeding. And that's sometimes like a compromise.
Yeah.
The other thing is that you don't really see as much nipple when the baby's at the breast as people sometimes think. So if you, in the early days of breastfeeding, just breastfeed in front of a mirror and really see what somebody else would see, it's often less than what people are thinking. Sometimes just having a undershirt or a breastfeeding shirt under your regular shirt can help.
Mm-hmm.
Looking up and making eye contact. People tend to follow your gaze. So if you're looking at their face, they're going to feel compelled maybe to look at your face too.
Yeah, I felt that. I can understand that. You briefly mentioned La Leche League. So could you actually share a little bit of info with people about what that is?
Definitely. La Leche League is amazing. If you don't know, La Leche League was an organization started in the 1950s in Illinois by seven women at a church picnic. That's the story.
So cool.
And some of them were breastfeeding and some of them had wanted to breastfeed and had been unsuccessful. And the 1950s was a really rough time in America if you wanted to be breastfeeding your baby.
Mm-hmm.
Because there wasn't a lot of information and support at that point. So they just kind of formed a group to support each other. And over time, it's grown and grown. It's international now. And it's parent to parent peer support. So leaders have breastfed their own babies for at least a year and then have some additional training. And we know that when people have a community of other people who are doing the same thing, right? The study group, if you're in calculus, or the breastfeeding group, if you're breastfeeding your baby, it's easier. And so it's a good resource if you need specific information, but also if you're looking for a group of people who are doing what you're doing, who are, you know, trying to figure out how to parent a young baby and using breastfeeding as one of those tools.
Yeah.
Everything is virtual now with the pandemic, but there is support either one-on-one from a leader or they're meeting virtually in groups now, and it's always free and just a nice way to find other people, you know, in your village.
Yeah.
Doing the same thing you are.
Yeah. And I that's another way, if people are feeling like they need a little bit more support and they feel like it's not happening within their own family or their own friend group, just having those resources that they could reach out to or be a part of. And like you said, like, there are virtual things right now, and sometimes even prior to the whole pandemic that we're dealing with right now, they had virtual things. New mom groups, just talking about the things that are happening, especially if you're a new mom and you're breastfeeding and you're trying to figure it out, or it's important to feel like you're supported in general, whether it's in person, which obviously would be more ideal if you had the people surrounding you, providing you with support, but also being able to have that support outside of the home too, I feel like is very important, especially in the immediate postpartum.
Yeah. And so many of those things that people are experiencing that they feel like it's new to them isn't actually new, right? So you were talking about this, like, how do I breastfeed around my in-laws who aren't that supportive? Or what do I do at a family gathering or whatever? Other people have walked that walk already.
Right.
And so you can often not have to reinvent the wheel, get support and get tricks and tips too about how to negotiate some of those situations.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're so right. There are some people who they've dealt with it and they kept going and kept breastfeeding, and then some people who didn't. So it's just like, I just want people to be able to have options for what that support is and what that support looks like. So I'm glad that you mentioned that, and I will include that in the show notes for everybody. And if you have any other resources besides yourself, obviously, if you'd like to include that, we can always include that in the show notes as well.
That sounds great.
One thing that I also was thinking about while we were chatting was the topic of nursing to sleep. And I know this is kind of like a controversial, not really controversial, but a lot of people have very specific opinions about it. So some people are against nursing to sleep, and then other people are for nursing to sleep. So would you mind sharing your thoughts on that?
Sure. It's like one of those things that so often comes up at a Lolechi League meeting.
Does it?
I mean, for the baby, breastfeeding is like duct tape. So we call it breastfeeding. It makes it sound like it's about feeding. And of course, it is about milk, but it's about so much more. And so it's a way for the baby to comfort themselves. It's a way for the baby to fall asleep. It's a way for the baby to regulate their heart rate, their breathing, their blood pressure, their blood sugar. And so it's a totally normal and natural thing for them to fall asleep at the breast. If you have a newborn who's really sleepy, who keeps falling asleep at the breast, then we, you know, would want to look at transfer, and are they falling asleep before the letdown because it's too much work to get a letdown, or
right,
during a letdown because it's too overwhelming.
Right.
But for a baby that has enough diapers every day and, you know, is growing and all of that, falling asleep at the breast is the most normal thing in the world. And the Lolechi League that we were talking about has a great resource on this. It's called Sweet Sleep.
Sweet Sleep.
And it's a book just about breastfeeding and sleep. And what they did was they looked at three categories of babies: the breastfed baby, the baby who gets bottles of formula, and the baby who gets bottles of human milk. And those are really like three categories. And babies in each of those categories are different.
Mm-hmm.
But for the baby who is breastfed, you know, breastfeeding and co-sleeping are twins. They often go together.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at the research in that and Sweet Sleep about how babies will often be in a protective cradle curl. So the mom lies on her side with her knee up and her arm over her head, and the baby in that safe space in between. And that's something that our great, great, great grandmothers have been doing for a really long time.
Yeah. You know, I'm just loving all the things that you're bringing up, because you're normalizing them. You're making people realize that these things are normal. These things have been going on for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years. And for me, when I became a mom, I felt like these things that just felt so natural to me were seen as something that was so not conventional, not normal. But like you said, breastfeeding and co-sleeping are tied together. Right. We ended up co-sleeping because it was just so much easier. And literally the way that you just described, like sleeping around your baby, that's exactly how we do it. Right. And I remember feeling like people were like, oh, well, no, like the baby needs to go in the crib. The baby needs to go in the crib. And I'm like, but this is what feels right. So this is what we're going to do. And I feel like me personally, like I have come to a point where I feel very comfortable speaking about the things that matter and the things that are important to me and following my instincts specifically with our daughter. But I know that there are a lot of people who, if somebody was saying, no, 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 don't do that, don't do that, you should be doing this, they'll follow that lead. So I'm just really grateful that you mentioned that and talked about that, because it is completely normal for that to be done as a mother. So it's something that I think that we need to be talking about more so people understand that it's okay to do that.
Definitely. It's one of those things, if you survey people before they've had their babies, mm-hmm. most people are going to say they're not going to sleep with their baby. But then if you survey them in the first few weeks postpartum, most of them are sleeping for some or all of most nights with their babies. Yep. Because the babies only sleep when they're near their parents, and the parents only sleep when the babies are sleeping. So it's not philosophy anymore. It's just survival.
Yeah.
And there was a study about how many people were co-sleeping with their babies and then what they were telling their pediatricians. The people were lying to their pediatricians, right? So the pediatricians have this like distorted view of what's happening with infant sleep in America.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're totally right, because they're afraid to share that they're sleeping with their baby, because a lot of people see co-sleeping as dangerous, and there are safe ways to do it. It's just being mindful of it and paying attention to it. And it is able, like you're totally capable of being able to sleep safely with your baby. It's just educating yourself on it, talking to your partner about it if there's a partner in the picture, and just making sure that both you and your baby are safe.
Right. Well, Let You League has online, you can look it up, the Safe Sleep 7, which is seven basic guidelines. Because if we say to people, don't co-sleep, people still co-sleep, but they do it in ways that aren't as safe,
like
on the living room couch or accidentally in a rocking chair. And when it's done deliberately and people take steps to make everybody be safe, it's much better than the sneaking, sneaking around co-sleeping or the accidental co-sleeping.
Yeah.
People are so tired.
I mean, honestly, I did not think that we were going to end up co-sleeping, but we did. And I just went with it, and it's been so much easier, and I've gotten so much more sleep because of it.
Yeah.
So one thing that you touched on when you were talking about like the different ways that people feed their babies, whether it's breastfeeding, whether it's bottle feeding, whether it's formula or breast milk, that I kind of wanted to touch on, because I learned this and I had no idea prior to having my own baby, about how if you pump milk at different times of the day, that it impacts your baby differently. Because say you pump that milk in the morning and then you go to give that milk that you pumped in the morning to your baby at night, it actually has different things in it, so the baby responds differently to it. Could you chat about with that for a few minutes?
Yeah. You know, there's never been a study where they look at human milk and they're like, wow, this is actually simpler and less complicated than we thought before. It's like every time they do research, there's some other cool, interesting thing about human milk. And so that's a relatively recent thing that we understand, is that human milk is on a 24-hour clock. And mm-hmm. so there's different hormonal cues. Melatonin is one of them, that are at different levels in the milk. Sleep, baby, it's nighttime. Wake up, baby, it's morning. And that's not to like make people obsessive or crazy. I mean, if you pump a bottle of milk and you give it to your baby at a different time of day, it's okay. But it's more just to be like, wow, here's another thing that human milk does that we didn't even know about.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, because one of the techniques that people sometimes sort of fall into is pumping in the morning when milk production is higher. Your production is highest about 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. And then giving babies those bottles around 4, 5, 6, 7 p.m. at the low milk production time of day, when babies tend to cluster feed, mm-hmm. Rather than giving into the cluster feeding. So now that we know that about, you know, the cyclical nature of milk, you wonder if sometimes you're making it harder in the late afternoon, giving the baby those bottles you pumped in the early morning.
Yeah.
Not to say not to do it if that's how it gets you through your day, but just something to think about.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you to talk about cluster feeding a little bit, because I feel like people have a kind of like a general idea of what it is sometimes, but some people don't know what it is. Just kind of what it looks like and what it looks like to somebody when they're going through a period where their baby is cluster feeding.
Right. So cluster feeding is more frequent feeding, and we tend to see it more late afternoon, early evening, as the baby's coming to the end of their day, and the parents are too. And it's partly related to the fact that there's lower milk volume typically at that time of day.
Okay.
So it's interesting, as there's less milk volume, there actually is more fat in the milk. So the caloric difference isn't that great, but the volume is. And so babies tend to want to feed more 4, 5, 6, 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
Kind of the time that people want to make dinner, eat dinner, clean up from dinner. my baby is going to be 21 on Wednesday, but
oh my gosh.
One of the things that I did when I was nursing my own kids was kind of surrender to it.
Yep.
So many of these things, if you can surrender to it, you know, we're talking about the co-sleeping, the baby wearing, just kind of like giving up to the things that the baby needs, rather than superimposing our adult ideas on it.
Yep.
But if you think about the baby needs to feed the newborn 10 to 12 times at a minimum in 24 hours. One of the things I used to tell myself, okay, I fed her at 4, I'm feeding her at 5, I'm probably going to feed her at 6 and at 7. But what does that mean, right? I'm getting in 4 of those, say, 12 feeds right now, mm-hmm. right? So maybe we're going to kind of set ourselves up for a longer sleep stretch at night, you know, mm-hmm. having checked off a lot of those boxes already.
Yeah.
And someone else can do the dishes.
Yeah. I love that you use the word surrender, because I've been kind of reflecting back on this past year since my daughter just turned 1. And that was one of the words that I chose to kind of explain this year, or what the
right.
word for this year was, just surrendering to things. And I feel that our society just has this view, not everybody, but a lot of people have this view where we expect babies to be born and to be on schedules. And if they're crying, then they're not a good baby. If they're not sleeping through the night, then they're not a good baby, in quotation marks, or air quotes, I should say, because nobody can see me doing that. It's just surrendering to things. And like you said, with the co-sleeping, for me, it was just like, okay, if I let her sleep with me and we sleep together, I get sleep, she gets sleep, she gets to eat when she wants to. I know that she's eating. It's just how it has to be. And also at that point, it was like survival mode. It was like, how do I sleep? How do we get things done? So I love that so much. And I think that being mindful of the fact that babies are not, they're not robots. They're not going to immediately be on schedules like when we want them to, when we expect them to be. So kind of lowering the expectations surrounding that and kind of just going with it, just going with the ebbs and flows, the emotional roller coaster of postpartum. Yeah, I love that. I love that you shared that so much. And I just think it's important to share, because a lot of people feel so much pressure being a new parent and being a new mom. Whether you're breastfeeding, whether you're bottle feeding, no matter what it is, there's so much pressure and so many people telling you what you should or shouldn't be doing. So just surrendering and following your mama instinct, whatever feels good to you as a mom, I feel like is just, it's important. And also being able to communicate that with the people around you so they hear what you're saying and can understand and kind of just support you through that. Because if we don't tell people, they don't know.
I agree. And I think it's such a big deal that your baby is 1. I just think that whole first trip around the sun is such a, especially with the first baby, it's such an adventure and it's such a victory to make it to 1. I just, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's been interesting. And I've just been trying to spend this last week just reflecting back on what this year has looked like and what it's been. And it's a wild ride, but I'm grateful for it and I'm thankful for it. Even the harder times, like it makes you realize that life is crazy and messy and beautiful and it can be all of these things at the same time.
Yeah.
But yeah, one thing that I also wanted to ask you about in terms of breastfeeding was ways that you feel like we can support women, or like kind of like give them encouragement if they're feeling like they don't have that support, or I'm trying to figure out like the best way to phrase it. Just like, I know we talked about having different resources, but if there are people who say they really, really want to breastfeed, but they're not feeling like A, they know enough, or B, they will have that support. Are there any specific things that you might tell somebody? Like if a client comes to you and is feeling really defeated, if they've been trying to breastfeed and it's not working very well, or even, I guess we could even briefly talk about that, the connection between that and like if your baby has a tongue tie, we could talk about that too. Whatever you feel like works best.
Sure. So just thinking about what to do if you're struggling as a new breastfeeding mom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think some of it starts with realistic expectations. You know, like the first day on the job is not usually the day where you know exactly what to do and what to expect and what's going to happen next.
Right.
So some of that surrender, the first 2 weeks, I think, are usually the hardest. Not just because of breastfeeding, but because first baby, you're figuring out how to be a parent, you're recovering from labor and birth.
Right.
There's a lot, you're not sleeping the way you used to. There's a lot going on.
Right.
So, having as much support, and some of that is just physical support so that you don't have to do anything that anyone else can do. In some ways COVID is making this much harder, but in some ways it's actually not. There's no place to go. Stay home, have people drop off meals for you if you can. No one's going to see your messy house, just kind of surrender to it and defeating the baby. I think skin to skin can make a really big difference in the early days. So it's like the word has gotten out about skin to skin for that first hour after birth,
mm-hmm.
but skin to skin is a gift for parents and babies for weeks afterwards. So doing as much both parents, as much skin to skin as you can, that helps with bonding, raises your oxytocin levels, helps to regulate the baby so they're not spending as much energy to regulate themselves. Mm-hmm. So that helps with weight gain and more frequent feeding. You know, it's kind of that surrender. We talked about co-sleeping and baby wearing, and skin to skin is another really important tool, you know, whether people are breastfeeding or not.
Yeah.
So that expectation that things are going to be more challenging in the beginning, but also reaching out for help so you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
An IBCLC consult can make a huge difference for people. And sometimes we're discovering there might be something, like you mentioned, a tongue tie, something that's underlying thing that's making breastfeeding difficult right now. And sometimes there's not. Sometimes we're just kind of piecing together a plan that's going to make things a little bit more easy in the beginning. So people shouldn't be sitting at home by themselves and like wondering if they're doing it right or if things are okay. You know, that's maybe the most important message, is just to reach out and to get help.
Yeah. And I think that's one thing too, that people struggle with, especially I know moms, is just asking for help, because in our society, it's like moms are just supposed to know how to do everything. They're supposed to do everything. And that's just how it is.
Right.
But if you're struggling,
very American.
Oh my gosh, I know, it drives me crazy when I learn about the ways that other countries support moms in the postpartum period. It just blows my mind that America is so behind the times on that.
Yeah.
But that could be like a whole nother podcast episode.
A podcast on what's wrong with American culture.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, so because I remember the first couple weeks, the first few days, Lula was kind of like in and out with feeding. She was kind of very sleepy. She was a little bit jaundiced after birth. And so I was just like, am I producing enough? And then I was really engorged, and then she wasn't feeding, and I was like, is something wrong with her latch? Does she have a tongue tie? What's happening? But I've heard some people talking about tongue ties, and in other countries, they don't correct them as much as they do in America. Is that true? Do you know about that?
I mean, it's very regional. I think, you know, in the Boston area, there are a lot of resources, and a lot of people, if they realize that that's a problem, have support and are able to correct it. There's certainly places in the U.S. where that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you compare like what we do to say what's happening in Europe, there are more releases happening here.
Yeah. I found that interesting, because I feel like And there are holistic ways to do things, and then there are also like more medicalized ways to do things. So I'm always curious to hear about it from both sides, specifically with someone like you who has worked with a lot of different clients. And I'm sure some people have revised these tongue ties where they go in and they have, is it technically a dentist who does it? I don't know if that's
yes, ENTs can do it, but like I only refer to laser dentists.
Yeah, and they use ENTs a little are laser.
Using scissors.
Yeah. Would you mind actually sharing a little bit about what that looks like, or like what it would be like if a parent, say their baby did need to go get a tongue tie and they did choose to do it with a laser, just kind of like with the, I know there's like a healing process after the fact as well.
Yeah. So tongue ties are a huge topic. There are more releases that are being done now. And some of it I think is because there's more awareness, you know, where a generation ago, if people had babies that couldn't transfer milk or it was painful, they often just, you know, went to a bottle more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And this also seems as though there are more tongue ties happening than they're used to as well, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
From a lactation perspective, we're looking at, does the baby, is the baby able to elevate the posterior part of their tongue easily in order to transfer milk efficiently? If they can't do that, they're typically working harder to transfer less milk. And when they transfer less milk, that can impact milk production, right? It's demand and supply. So mm-hmm. baby's not keeping up with the demand and supply end can be affected. We also see a lot of times that with tongue tie, not always, but often breastfeeding is painful because the latch is more shallow. The baby's doing other things with their muscles to try to compensate because they can't lift the back part of their tongue.
Mm-hmm.
So when an IBCLC talks about tongue ties, or there's also lip ties and buccal ties, we're talking about how it's impacting feeding.
Right.
It can have other impacts later on as well. I mean, dentists are typically looking at, is it going to impact, you know, the shape of the palate as the child grows, which is going to impact how much space they have for their teeth,
mm-hmm.
and these, speech issues, airway issues. But from a lactation perspective, we're really looking at, does it impact breastfeeding?
Right.
And then in terms of the release, you know, the best release situation is where someone's working with an IBCLC starting before the release. Even if they're not breastfeeding, we help with parents who are exclusively pumping, which sometimes happens with a tie, or babies that are just with formula. We can help with oral exercises pre-release, get the baby ready, protect the milk production, help the nipples heal, whatever it is. Body work is also really important, working with a chiropractor or an osteopath who's experienced with tongue tie babies.
Oh, cool.
And then the release, and then more body work and another IBCLC consult post-release.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up too, because that was one thing. I had been seeing a chiropractor while I was pregnant. And I feel like a lot of people are kind of afraid to bring their baby to a chiropractor because they think it's going to be very, very rough for the baby when in reality, if that chiropractor is trained to work with moms and babies, it is not like cracking crazy, that sort of thing.
No cracky poppy on a newborn.
Exactly. And so, I don't think people realize the amount of pressure and all the things that happen for the baby as they either come out of the birth canal, or even if you if you go through a C-section, birth is birth. It's still a big event for both mom and baby. And like you said, paying attention to that and being mindful of that, and body work can magically change that. Like your baby can, I've talked to so many moms who were, they were like, my baby was super gassy, they were super fussy, we went and we saw the chiropractor and it completely changes, like there was a different baby. So just taking that into consideration, that it's a big, birth is a big event for everybody, including the baby.
I agree. Body work can be a game changer. The first place I took my kids, we had a pediatrician that came to our house, but the first place we went was to the chiropractor.
Wow.
And I had a chiropractor who would adjust my babies while I was breastfeeding them, which always made so much sense to me. Like, we're trying to work on this function, work on it while I'm doing this thing,
that
you know?
That's amazing.
Almost all the babies I see, I refer for body work. Now, if breastfeeding is going awesome, I usually don't see that, right? So I only see people who are struggling. But almost always I'm referring them to body work. Like you mentioned, things in the birth process, a long labor can affect a baby, mm-hmm. but coming out very quickly can as well. We want the baby to go back and forth and back and forth under the pubic arch and then right. extend when they come out. We need that head extension at the breast. So if the baby really came out quickly, they haven't done that extension. If they came out via cesarean, they didn't get to have that extension. So a lot of babies are really helped by body work. Any baby where I see them and I know how they were lying in utero,
yeah.
we want to help them. So a baby that's always looking right or always looking left, or a breech baby with their feet up by their ears, want to help them be more comfortable. They're not in utero anymore.
Right.
And that those preferences, they affect breastfeeding, but I think they just affect how comfortable they are in their little bodies all the time.
Yeah. One more question I had for you before we wrap up, was actually about like diet and breastfeeding. Because I know that some people say that they feel like diet does not impact breastfeeding at all. But for me personally, and for my daughter, I felt like the things that I was eating in the beginning really, really impacted her and like her, how gassy she was. And so I cut certain things out, but would you mind just sharing your thoughts on it? I'm always just curious to hear what lactation consultants have to say about it.
Yeah. I mean, diet is huge. I mean, first of all, there's some sort of myth out there that you can somehow not eat the food, not have that mineral or vitamin in your body, and still it will be in your breast milk by magic. Right.
Right.
But if you can't give what you don't have, so good nutrition is important across the lifespan, but in pregnancy, when you're breastfeeding, and in a lot of cultures, you know, everybody knows, all the grannies know, there are certain foods that you eat when you're pregnant and certain foods that you eat when you're breastfeeding, which is really interesting. I think in our culture, it's more like eat whatever you want. And then if you have a problem making enough milk, change your diet real quick.
Right.
Instead of just relying on that knowledge and wisdom that people have developed over generations and centuries about right. what to eat. You know, there's a myth out there that if you're breastfeeding, you need to drink a lot of water and like drink water, but you know, drink water to thirst. You don't have to drink extra water for some reason.
Yeah.
The American Academy of Pediatrics talks about supplementing all breastfed babies with vitamin D, mm-hmm. which is interesting. And it's because when they look at the D levels of human milk from American moms, often there's not enough,
mm-hmm.
But it's because we don't have enough. So there was a study, if people supplemented, it was 6,400 IU of D, they had enough D in their bodies and in their milk, you know? So I think it's just one example of how you can't give what you don't have.
Right.
So.
No, I appreciate that. That was essentially what I was looking for. I think just paying attention and being mindful of the things that we're consuming and how they impact us, ourselves, but then also how they impact our babies. Because I noticed an immediate difference as soon as I cut certain things out. So I think that, like you said, just listening to your body, paying attention to your intuition, what it's telling you, what your body's telling you, what your baby's telling you, just following your natural instincts, following your baby's cues, you know, we get so far away from that in our culture and it's hard. And I know it's hard for a lot of moms too, to try and figure that all out on top of being a new mom and on right, top of right. all the societal pressures. So I just wanted to see if there were any, last words or pieces of advice that you wanted to leave with listeners today before we start to wrap up.
I can't believe where the time has gone.
I
mean, I just wanted to say one more thing about pain. We talked about low production and concerns about that, but, I think another common myth is that somehow breastfeeding is going to hurt. And if it hurts, just kind of grin and bear it.
Yeah.
And you know, pain with breastfeeding is often a sign that something's wrong. Typically, it's a shallow latch.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a workable solution to just kind of wait and hope that it gets better. If you're having pain when you're breastfeeding, you know, I would suggest reaching out to an IBCLC, getting help,
mm-hmm.
You know, looking at how to get a deeper latch or what's keeping the baby from having a deeper latch, looking at how to heal the damage. Coming up with a plan.
Yeah.
Because it's a myth that somehow, you know, our grandmothers all the way back to the beginning of time were just like sitting around in caves, grinning and bearing it. You know, like the human race would be extinct if breastfeeding was that painful.
Right. And even you just mentioning that right now, I feel like one thing to mention on top of that is that moms and women in general, we tend to hold on to pain and not really tell people when we're in pain or if we're going through something. So it's especially important, especially during the postpartum period when your body's already going through all of these things. You're healing, you're trying to get sleep, you're trying to bond with your baby. If you're in pain, that needs to be addressed. So I really, really hope that people listening to this episode, whether they know somebody who's gone through that and have had a painful experience breastfeeding themselves, that they just, they know that they have those resources, that they can reach out to a lactation consultant. So I so appreciate you saying that and reminding people that it's not supposed to be painful. It's supposed to be beautiful.
Right.
And it
right.
might be a struggle in the beginning. Everyone's journey is different. But just that support is there if you do need it. So could you share with people where they can find you or reach out to you, if they have questions or if they're looking for support?
Sure. The easiest way is to find me is through my website, which is wellpregnancy.com. I'm doing virtual lactation consults right now, which means I'm working all across the country. I also teach prenatal breastfeeding classes and childbirth classes. So if you're listening and you're pregnant, this is actually a great time to start to prepare for breastfeeding.
Yeah, and I love that you share that. So on your website, will it share or will it show what the list of your classes, or would that be something that
yes,
it is on there?
It's all up on the website, and if it also has my contact information, people can just send an email if
perfect.
They have more questions or they're looking to book something.
Awesome. So I will include that in the show notes so anybody who wants to reach out to you can reach out to you that way. Thank you so, so much for coming on the podcast and for sharing all of your knowledge and your experience with us. It's just something that I feel that so many people are going to benefit from. And I really just loved having this open conversation about it.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been wonderful to chat with you. I feel like this is such an important topic just to get information out about. So thanks for helping with that.
It so is. Well, thank you so, so much, listeners, for joining us this week. We hope that you guys have learned a lot from this episode. As always, if you have questions for myself or if you have questions for Julie, please feel free to reach out to either one of us. And we hope that you have a great weekend, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.